Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
So I have a joke for you. A guy walks into a bar with jumper cables wrapped around his neck, and the bartender looks him up and down and says, "Look, I'll let you hang out, but you better not try to start anything."
I am Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Newnham, and from APM, American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download. 1 hour of culture, food, and humor to fuel your weekend conversations.
You just got a joke from Charles Russo, author of a new book about Bruce Lee. That'll help break the ice. We'll be speaking with him later. Plus, we chat with actress Kristen Bell, star of Veronica Mars, Frozen, and the hit NBC show The Good Place.
Also coming up, soul singer Sharon Jones shares her digits, comic Josh Gondelman celebrates his sublime relationship, and Icelandic musician Júníus Meyvant provides a party soundtrack as cool as the Northern Lights.
And if you're now experiencing déjà vu, that's because this is an encore presentation of a show we first ran in July. So cast your mind back to a time when the word holiday meant building sandcastles instead of eating dry turkey, and when, as at any dinner party, we started with small talk.
Now for a story you might not have heard, we are joined by Sadie Stein. She is a contributing editor at the Paris Review. Sadie, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about a horror film written by robots.
Which in itself sounds like a horror film.
Exactly.
That's true. This means I'm going to have to buy dinner for my screenwriter friends some more. What's going on here?
Well, this movie, Impossible Things, is an independent horror film which partially used augmented intelligence software to analyze audience response data and figure out exactly what would scare them.
So this robot's broken the human ceiling that's been holding down robots from getting into Hollywood.
Exactly. The metal ceiling has been cracked.
This isn't what we meant by welcoming diversity, but okay.
So how does this work?
Well, apparently audience reactions were analyzed, and the result is the scariest and creepiest horror film out there.
Who says that? That sounds like a publicity talking point.
This may or may not be either publicity or the robot himself.
But robot PR is next.
But apparently the result of this, people wanted ghosts, family relationships, a piano scene, and a bathtub scene.
They got me all figured out.
They got it. Exactly.
Well, Sadie, you are a writer yourself and you work with writers. How does this make you feel, this development?
I feel like I was not consulted to create this algorithm. So the specific things I like in a movie, which is to say, people emerging from wells, which is obviously the creepiest element, is going to be missing, and I reject it as the apotheosis of fright.
All right, Sadie Stein, thanks for giving us the small talk.
Anytime.
And now for a human-prepared cocktail. Once again, we tell you something that happened in history, then enlist a bartender to capture its essence in the form of a cocktail.
It's like history is a water park slide down which courses a wave of booze for grown-ups.
We'll start with the history. Around this time, back in 1927, the Georgia Institute of Technology enrolled its most famous student.
Michelle Phillippe tells the tale.
Yes, and it all begins with the tale of Georgia Tech's second most famous student. His name was William Edgar Smith, Ed for short, who, as an incoming freshman, was accidentally mailed two student enrollment forms. Instead of throwing the extra one away, he decided to use it to create a fictional student. Ed named his creation George P. Burdell, and he signed up the non-existent George for the same classes Ed took. Every time there was an assignment, Ed did it twice, once for himself and once for George, with the language and handwriting slightly changed so professors wouldn't catch on. Ed even enlisted fellow students to shout out, "Here," when George's name was mentioned during roll call. Thusly, Ed and his pals managed to convince the faculty George was a real person 4 years. Culminating one glorious day in 1930 when Georgia Tech bestowed upon him a Bachelor of Science degree. When Ed revealed his prank to the shocked administration, it immediately became an undying campus legend. Students still try to enroll George P. Burdell for classes. In fact, on several occasions, they've hacked Tech's computers and signed him up for every class the school offered. And each year, the student body celebrates George's birthday on April 1st. His legend extends beyond campus, though. In World War II, George was listed as a crew member on a B-17 bomber. For 12 years, Mad Magazine listed him as a member of their board of directors. And in 2001, when Time Magazine polled readers about who should be Person of the Year, George P. Burdell led the pack, until editors took him out of the running.
That was the history lesson, and now, as is our wont, we are going to create a cocktail out of that story. We reached out to Molly Gunn. She is a bartender at the Porter Beer Bar in Atlanta, Georgia, the home of Georgia Tech and presumably George Burdell. Molly, welcome.
Thank you so much.
You heard the story. What drink did it inspire you to make?
Well, we have a fabulous brewery here in town, owned by two Tech alums, and the brewery is called Second Self.
Wait, is it called Second Self because
of
this?
Yeah, the brewery is called Second Self. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, my goodness. Maybe everyone who kind of goes there is predisposed towards having a split personality.
Yes, exactly. So okay. I used a beer that they make called Thai Wheat, real light and summery. And
right.
We used a locally made vodka. It's called 13th Colony. Put 2 ounces of that in the beer. So.
All right, that turns it into a cocktail, because until then, it was just a beer.
It was just a beer, exactly. And then Georgia, you usually think of Georgia peaches, but to go hand in hand with the twist of the mysterious split personality, Georgia actually grows the most blueberries in the U.S.
Wow, I had no idea.
We grow way more blueberries than peaches. I know, everyone thinks of us as the peach capital.
Everyone can be forgiven because your license plate has a peach on it, right? Or it says
exactly.
The peach state.
And yes, us southern girls are often called Georgia peaches.
Georgia blueberries. Yeah, it doesn't have the same ring.
No, it does not have the same ring. So we made a blueberry syrup with some of those lovely locally grown blueberries. And yeah, and that's your cocktail.
Is there a garnish for this drink?
Just a few fresh blueberries on a toothpick. That way you know what you're drinking.
And it looks like a little mouse dumbbell there.
Exactly.
So Molly, do you have any imaginary friends? I know you didn't attend Tech, but...
You know, I have enough real friends and problems without fake friends and problems.
Okay.
And I can't believe that they did that guy's homework. That's a really good imaginary friend if you do his homework, too.
Let's just hope that he didn't pay... Burdell's student loans as well.
Oh, my goodness, no.
Enrico, since we're on the subject,
yeah.
I guess we might as well reveal that All Things Considered's Robert Siegel is also a fictional character created by Audie Cornish.
That's right. She also does his voice, and also the voice of, quote, Terry Gross.
Yeah. NPR is really just Audie Cornish and a bunch of engineers in Washington.
Secrets out.
But folks, our drinks are real. You can find the recipes at dinnerpartydownload.org. And now the soundtrack, in which an excellent musician DJs your dinner party.
And today our guest is Iceland's own Júníus Meyvant. He won his home country's equivalent of a Grammy for Song of the Year, and he's making an international name for himself with soulful folk pop that's both emotive and uplifting. His debut album, Floating Harmonies, just came out.
Here he is to present a playlist and to be silly.
Hi, I'm Júníus Meyvant, and if I would be in a party right now, I would be fighting with my friends in a good way, like a wrestling match or something. Until the other man passes out, then... No. Okay, I'm just gonna be regular now, okay? Here's my dinner party soundtrack. This time last, then I fall. Seems like you don't want the love of this man at all. I've been lately been listening to a lot of Bee Gees, so the first song I would play in my party is Fanny Be Tender. So if you take a life, we used to take long drives around Iceland. My daddy had a lot of CDs in his car, so I think he introduced me to Bee Gees. I thought it was a little bit strange music at first, but when you hear how the brothers' voices come together, it's like a one perfect disco voice. It's the smoothest dancing song I've ever heard. I would climb on the smallest table, and that table would break, and the music would stop for a second. But the greatest thing about music is the silence between the music, you know? Then you learn to appreciate what comes next. The second song I would play is Backdoor Man by Howling Wolf.
Ah, yeah. A backdoor man.
It's beginning of Chicago blues. And his voice is like, I don't know, if you would distort a trash can. It's like if a transformer would swallow a trash can and start to sing. I thought his guitar was really small, but it's a big guitar, you know. But on the picture, it looks like a ukulele because he has these huge hands, like a baseball glove with skin over it.
Well done, men don't know.
And, you know, if you listen to Iggy Pop, Captain Beefheart, Tom Waits, you can hear Howling Wolf in them, you know. He was as rough as you can get. He's in your face, and he's not gonna knock on your door. He's gonna kick it down.
I'd rather be dead, sleeping in the ground.
Track number three would be How Blue Can You Get by B.B. King, live in Cook County Jail. For 2 minutes, there's no singing. It's just B.B. playing his guitar. And I think it's one of the best guitar solos ever recorded, period. Because it's just his guitar, no effects, just true emotions. And this guitar solo always makes me stand up and scream. Every time it gets me. In the song, he tells her about, you know, I gave you a brand new Ford, but then the woman said, I want a Cadillac. You know, I brought you in my penthouse and you said it was just a shack. It's a funny lyric.
I gave you a brand new Ford, but you said I want a Cadillac. I let you live in my penthouse. You said it was just a shack.
I've been married for 11 years now, so I am in a good relationship. I have two kids. Maybe that's why I find it interesting, because it's not my burden to bear, this kind of song. I'm truly sorry, people, but I had to pick one song by myself, Junius Meyvant. And the track I would choose is Be a Man. That song is an instrumental song, and it's about, you know, not like be a man. It's about being a man, a true man, a man who apologizes, a man who helps, a man who loves his neighbor, a man who makes a fool of himself at the party and doesn't care.
A stirring party soundtrack from Junius Meyvant. His debut album, Floating Harmonies, actually contains many examples of his fine singing voice. It's out now.
All right, coming up, soul singer Sharon Jones dishes on her digits, and actor Kristen Bell reveals her dark side.
I use emojis, and I end almost every sentence in a smiley face.
Chilling. Ugh. When the Dinner Party Download continues.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. We should let you know this is an encore broadcast of an episode we first aired in July. It's aged beautifully, mind you. In a few minutes, you'll hear about the time comic Josh Gondelman fell in love-hate with the Great Bad Song. But first, let's meet our guest of honor.
Yes, and this week it's Sharon Jones, the unstoppable lead singer of the funk and soul band Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. The 10-piece act has been releasing albums and touring the world for about two decades. In 2014, they earned a Grammy nomination for Best R&B Album. Here's a clip of a tune off that one. It's called Retreat.
Play with me.
The year before that song came out, Sharon was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. A documentary called Miss Sharon Jones follows her during that period. When I met with her back in July, I asked how she was feeling about her career when she got her diagnosis.
The next album is coming out, and you know, you're looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because with us, we have to do shows to make music, you know. It's not like a bunch of royalties coming. It's not like we're selling millions and we got...
Yeah.
You know, millions of dollars
you're
coming in.
You're a touring band, yeah.
Yeah. You're working hard to get what you have. And I had just came back sort of off of a little vacation from Hawaii.
Mm.
And while I was in Hawaii, I just kept saying my eyes look yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And I was itching, you know. And I come back home and I go to my doctor. He looks at me, sends me to this oncologist, you know, doc set me up for MRI. He seems a little uptight when we told him he was going to New York. So he says, well, you can go to New York. This is how I found out I had cancer. He said, go to New York and get your fancy doctors or Yankee doctors or something like that. And they're going to tell you the same thing. You have cancer. I was like, cancer? You know, and yeah.
He hadn't even had told you his diagnosis yet.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't think he realized to this day that he probably did that.
And that's kind of, you know, where this documentary begins. Before we get to that, your journey to becoming a touring musician who was successful, who had a new album coming out, it had been a long one. You'd been a corrections officer, you sang in wedding bands. A music executive once said, you're not worth investing in because you're too big, too old, too black, too short.
Yeah.
What made you keep trying to do music when you were well into your 30s
My first album out when I was 40. Well,
yeah.
That I knew I was talented. I knew I had a gift just being in the church. And just, you know, realize what my mom said, you know, that guy was a knucklehead. You know, you're a beautiful black woman and pretty soon people will accept you for your voice, not the way you look.
There must have been such a big temptation, though, because you were living with your mother in Queens. You mm-hmm. you were making ends meet to not come home after work and go out singing. Why? What motivated you to, like, push harder?
I just knew that we had something, the Dap Kings. Once Mark Ronson got involved and Amy, they're like, oh, you know, the band comes to me. We're going to do this thing for this British girl.
When you sang, you guys worked with Amy Winehouse. Yeah,
soul for Back singing Black. British. You're like, what?
Yeah.
You know, all right. And the next thing you know, a couple of weeks later, it's all in the newspaper. The British are coming. Next thing you know, Amy all on the show. The band played with her while she was in the States.
Yeah.
And I was like, we've been doing this for the last.
Yeah.
Amy Winehouse and Mark Ronson have listened to us over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And coming to us, they come into us because that's what we've been doing for the last few years.
Yeah.
And so if they can hit on something, we got something here. And I was like, this is the last job I'm gonna get, Gabe, y'all. We gotta make this work.
All the things I've been through just to sing this song. All the people I've seen come and go as I kept pushing along. I had to work at my prison guard telling me to do what they're told. Cause some wrecking neighbor told me I was too fat, too short, black and old. I had to direct the choir to let my voice out. Cause that's the only place that I can sing and be proud.
So you did make it work. The band has, 10, 11 members. It waxes and wanes a little bit.
Yeah.
Album after album, touring the world. This cancer diagnosis comes down. And now, the movie shows you have this amazing family, you have this amazing support group, including the Dap Kings and Dapettes. And at the same time, many of these people depended on you for their livelihood.
Yeah.
So how do you or did you process that idea that I'm dependent on and yet I physically, I can't do this?
No, that was the hard part, knowing that I couldn't do it, but they allowed me that. They kept all of those negative things. I saw that in the film. Mm. I refused to see the film before it was made.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it was out, when they was doing the screening of it, I was like, no, I'm going to wait to see it in the movie.
Yeah.
So I was just as amazed to find out what they went through, finding out Binky and his wife was
getting divorced, one of your guitarists,
And some of the other things that the other singers, some of them don't talk about, how everyone struggled.
Yeah.
And not only were they struggling, how I struggled, because you got to realize they wasn't paying for certain doctors. So I had a big medical bill. I mean, that whole year, I think I grossed maybe $4,000 or something like that. And it took us a couple of years to catch up.
There's a scene in this doc when you return to the Beacon Theater after your first bout of cancer and having gotten through it, and you're going on stage, and you're holding a cup and you're shaking. Do you remember that moment?
Oh yeah, I remember that moment.
Sold out crowd,
perfectly well, and I'm just praying. I'm just like, Lord, I know you. You didn't bring me this far to leave me. I'm back out here now. Take me through. Let me remember all of my lyrics and get down with that chemo brain,
So. You're smiling now. It seems like the music gives you an energy, and yet I wonder, is there a song in particular or a certain lyric when you sing it on this, right now, when you're doing these shows, battling, that has a certain, has more meaning to you? Or?
Well, no, it's just one of the songs that we do, Get Up and Get Out, on the album, it sort of sound like a little gospel western groove. But when I do it live, I got a stop it, and I get that Tina Turner roar. And it's going to mean it when I say get up and get out to cancer, to get up and get out.
You're, it's like speaking directly to
right,
this.
To it. And I take the words and play with them.
I've been there with you night after night. You leave before I see the morning light. I always say you ain't a welcome no more. But when you knock, I open up my door. I say get up, get up, get up.
We have two standard questions we ask our guests, and I want to run them by you. So the first one is, what question do you not like being asked in interviews?
How did you get started? I'm like, don't y'all know that by now? But, it doesn't matter because a lot of people don't know. So that's why I don't mind over and over again.
Getting the word out.
It doesn't bother me.
Well, you're a patient subject. Well, so, and then the second question is the opposite a little bit. Tell us something we don't know, and this is a fact. It could be a fact about you, or it could just be a neat fact about the world that not a lot of people know.
Well, you know what? I'll say something people don't know about me, myself.
Do it.
I was born with extra fingers.
What?
Yeah, I had 12 fingers. See right there? See that mark? And it was
one
over.
Oh, my goodness.
Here.
There are these little bumps.
There you go. Now y'all know.
Are those extra fingers?
I'm a little alien.
On your pinky, you have a little protrusion.
The little finger.
Looks like the beginning of another finger.
Yeah.
Is that to hold the microphone fast? Does that give you an extra?
I'm so glad.
When you're doing the mashed potato with a microphone, maybe that comes in handy.
Oh, yeah.
So many times there was a man who met a girl and took her hand. He told her, never will I leave you, my love.
Sharon Jones, the new documentary about her is called Miss Sharon Jones and A Bittersweet Coda. Sharon's currently on a world tour with Hall & Oates, but the cancer has returned. When I asked her about it, she was confident she would beat it once again.
Our thoughts are with her. And folks, to see a trailer for that doc, head to dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now, time to eavesdrop.
Comedian Josh Gondelman is up for an Emmy for his writing on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. His new comedy album, Physical Whisper, is out now. Today we overhear him tell a tale which tickles our fancy.
Hi, Hi, my name is Josh Gondelman, and I want to tell you the story about how I knew my girlfriend was the person I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. So it was the day of my grandmother's funeral, and it was a very Massachusetts funeral in a lot of ways. Like, my grandmother was cremated in a Tom Brady jersey, which is not conventional for Jews, first of all, but also that's a real fan. And when I heard that she was cremated in that jersey, I started to cry because I'd spent like $100 on that jersey. Plus, the playoffs were coming up, and we can't have that kind of karma going into the postseason, just burning team paraphernalia. I don't know if that's what Nana would have wanted. We spend the afternoon at my parents' house sitting Shiva, which is the Jewish custom of spending the day and days after with relatives and family members and family friends. And there's a lot of smoked fish and a lot of kind reminiscing. And my girlfriend was there, and she was meeting a lot of people that she'd never met. And even when you're within that circle, it's an emotionally grueling day. And from without, you're just being bombarded with new people. And she was a real champ about it. When the day kind of came to an end, we borrowed my mom's car. And we decided to go into the city and see some of our friends. And we turned on the radio. And in Boston, terrestrial radio is abysmal. It goes up to like 1997, then skips forward abruptly to that one Dropkick Murphys song from the Departed soundtrack, and then stops forever. It's a wasteland. And so the first song that we hear when we turn on the radio is Caress Me Down by Sublime, which is a very bad song. Sublime as a band is like a blacklight Che Guevara poster that you listen to. That's their whole vibe. And Caress Me Down is specifically a bad song. So it's a story in two languages, and that story is a man and a woman have a very explicit romantic encounter, and then they have it again in Spanish. And then the Spanish time she gets pregnant. And I don't know if that's racist, but it feels racist to me. So we're driving, I'm driving, and my girlfriend starts singing along super loud to Caress Me Down. She's like, when I see Maxie, makes me feel horny. Which, horny, my goodness, that's not a word you put in a love song. If that's something you include in your draft, delete it. Start fresh. It's not a song lyric. It's just something you put in a text message next to an eggplant emoji. We all know that. She keeps going. Because I'm the type of lover with the sensitivity. Kiss me neck and tickle me fancy. When she kiss my neck and tickle me fancy. Tickle me fancy? What are you talking about? Are you a pirate? So we get into the city. We see some friends, old friends of mine from Boston. We have a nice time. It really kind of lightens the psychic load of the day. We have a couple drinks, no more than the legal limit. We get back in the car to head back to the suburbs, and we turn on the radio, and the first song we hear is Caress Me Down by Sublime again. And at that point, I don't know what happened. I don't know whether we angered a wizard or some kind of curse has been levied against us, but there is no reason to hear that song twice ever from now on, never mind twice in one night in this decade. So this time, it's the Spanish part of the song, and my girlfriend doesn't know any of the Spanish lyrics. So instead of singing, she's just doing this dance where she's shaking her fists in my face like I just denied her a mortgage or something. So we get back to my parents' house, and we go up the stairs to my childhood bedroom, where we're staying in two twin beds pushed together like a couple from a 50s sitcom that almost figured out how to make love to one another despite already having three children. We get into bed, and it's so late, and I'm so tired, physically tired, emotionally exhausted, and I can only imagine what she's feeling. And just as I'm about to go to sleep, my girlfriend murmurs so gently, so sweetly, Josh, kiss my neck. And I say, of course, anything you want in the whole world. You've been so wonderful to me this day and throughout our entire relationship. You've been such a source of strength and support and love, and anything I can do to repay that, anything I can do to bring you comfort in this moment, kiss your neck, scratch your back, rub your feet, whatever it is, I'm here for you. And I lean in to give her the tiniest, softest kiss on the back of her neck, so gentle, like a physical whisper. And she leans over her shoulder, makes eye contact with one eye, like a shark would, and yells in my face, "And tickle me fancy." She caressed me, downed me in my childhood bedroom on the day of my grandmother's funeral. I don't know what they call that wherever you live, but where I'm from in Boston, Massachusetts, we call that a keeper. I wanted to propose right then. I really did, but I held off. I waited the next day. I went out and bought the Spanish Rosetta Stone, and I'll propose when she learns all the Spanish lyrics to that song, because I will be damned if I marry a woman who doesn't know all the words to our wedding song.
Josh Gondelman, his comedy album Physical Whisper is out now. And a postscript, Josh did eventually propose to his girlfriend with Sublime blasting in the background.
L'chaim.
It's a special sort of relationship.
Yeah.
And folks, speaking of postscripts, we are hosting a little social media contest that involves the postscript of your Thanksgiving feast.
Yes, we are less than a week away from the year's ultimate dinner party. Mm-hmm. And as we did last year, we'd like to see a photo of your table after the feasting is done. Mm. Because, you know, there's a certain beauty to a post-meal landscape, don't you think?
Of course I do. So before you do the dishes and fall immediately asleep, share a photo of your destroyed table and tag it with the hashtag DinnerPartyAftermath. We'll be reposting them on our own Instagram and Twitter accounts for the whole world to see.
All right, stick around, because coming up, Kristen Bell brings us some genuinely great advice, and we hear about Bruce Lee's pre-fame days when the Dinner Party download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the arts and leisure section of public radio. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. We hope your day is going swimmingly.
We do.
In a few minutes, Rico learns why not everyone on Earth loves Bruce Lee. But first, it's time for our weekly etiquette lesson.
Yes, each week you send in your questions about how to behave. And here to answer them this time around is actress Kristen Bell. She starred in the hit TV shows House of Lies and the cult hit Veronica Mars. She lent her voice to the sweet Princess Anna in the mega-hit Disney film Frozen. If you have a child, they are probably singing songs from that right now. And she was the off-screen narrator of the scandalous teen drama Gossip Girl. This week you can catch her in the new film Bad Moms, along with Mila Kunis, Catherine Hahn, Christina Applegate, and a slew of other funny people. And Kristen, it is an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I can't believe you had time to be on our show.
You know, for you guys, I will make it work.
Oh, my gosh.
And not only are you a busy actor, though, you yourself are a mother.
Yes.
This is a movie about a group of overburdened helicopter moms who decide to live a little bit, and they maybe end up living too much to the point where they're drunkenly trashing supermarkets.
Do they, though? How much is too much?
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's a good mom thing to do.
Well, how about you? How do you let off steam from being a mom?
I will say I have trouble staying up past 10:30. So mine would not be a night of partying, but it definitely would be, sadly, it's so much more similar to my character, who is just a mousy little overburdened mom, I have a monologue about my dream day, which is I get in a car accident, but not a car accident with like fire, where I just get slightly injured and I get to go to the hospital for 2 weeks and everyone comes to visit me and the nurses pamper me and it's all covered by my insurance. And that's not far off from a dream scenario.
But what would trigger that fantasy? What's a bad day at the Bell household?
Well, it's mostly when everybody's screaming. Everybody just screams. And if that's also a day where they've woken up really early, because the everything about kids is awesome, but the one thing that sucks about them is that they wake up so early. That's really the one thing that sucks. It's because everything else you can justify, like, sure, you have to bathe them and wipe their butt, but their skin is so soft and they smell so yummy. It's like your own personal heroin. But the thing that I can't find the joy in is when they wake up.
Is it possible? I don't have a kid. Is it possible to trick them with blackout curtains?
Somewhat, yes. If you set the scene perfectly and you're militant about it, like we are, we have blackout curtains. We have a white noise machine. The problem is the three-year-old now, the white noise machine is like an old tablet, and so now she knows how to use it.
No.
So like the other night, it was 11:30, and we just hear blasting from her room, Waylon Jennings, blasting. And we run in there. The lights are on.
The three-year-old.
Yeah, and they share a room, the 1.5-year-old and the 3-year-old. Uh-huh. The 3-year-old is blasting Waylon Jennings, and she's screaming, "It's for Daddy! It's Wayjens!"
That's beautiful, but I do love the idea that you would put parental controls on that tablet so she's not allowed to access Waylon Jennings.
Like I know, but
not pornography.
Like I know how to use anything on that tablet other than the white noise. Is cute of you to think.
She would be great at karaoke, it sounds like. A great companion for that.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah. Well, actually, speaking of singing, we would be remiss if we didn't mention Frozen.
Both of us have friends with young daughters who basically never stop singing the songs from this movie.
Please apologize to them for me. I'm so sorry.
Oh, nonsense. But you yourself grew up kind of a musical theater nerd. You studied musical theater in school. What was your Frozen?
Oh, I think it was The Little Mermaid. Mm. I was very into The Little Mermaid. Mm. Yeah, it came out around 89. I was prime time for that. I also really liked Aladdin, but really all those movies. It's funny because growing up, I was obsessed with Disney animation and I dreamed of being a part of it. That was kind of like the first thing on my bucket list when I was 6 or 7 years old. Mm. And I remember like having my old boombox and like putting Little Mermaid on in the background so I could hear the orchestration and pressing record and singing all of her songs into the boombox. I didn't really know why. And then of course my friends in high school found those tapes and, you know, embarrassment ensued. But it really was a lifelong dream fulfillment for me.
What's interesting is your daughter, you sang Little Mermaid, but your daughter sings Waylon Jennings. Are you concerned about her future?
No.
She might be an outlaw?
You know what? If she's an outlaw, more power to her. My husband always makes this comparison with us because we grew up about 20 minutes outside of each other in Michigan. And he was very into drugs for a very long time. Wow. And I was very straight and narrow and studied musical theater. And he came to LA and just drank a lot. And yet somehow, and we have very, very different perspectives on the world, yet somehow we exited the freeway at the same stop. You know, we're living in the same house, yeah. We have the same kids. So I don't really subscribe to feeling like any characteristic of anyone's personality can define them. Anybody can end up anywhere.
And for those who don't know, your husband is Dax Shepard, who is also a very successful actor.
Cutest one there is.
You're not biased.
But that is the sweet wisdom that we hope you'll bring to our listeners' etiquette questions. You ready for these?
Let's do it.
All right, this first one comes from JR in LA, and JR writes, I work with someone who uses the letters XO in some of her emails to colleagues, as in XO Janet. I feel like that phrase is now becoming more casual and less like love you, but still, it strikes me as weird. Is it okay in your book? I figured you would know if anyone.
Yes, and of course, XOXO is how your character in Gossip Girl signed off every episode.
Well, I have strong feelings about this one, and it might surprise you. I feel like because text and email, it's so difficult to establish tone. I use emojis and XOs, and I end almost every sentence in a smiley face. So I abuse them left and right. That said, I think if you're genuinely trying to say, I love you, maybe you should be doing it face to face, or you can elaborate a little so the reader knows that it's more than just a casual XO.
So it's like real talk, XOXO.
That would get the point across.
Real talk, heart emoji.
Yeah, there you go. Here's something from Bob in Chicago. Straightforward question. How long is too long to borrow someone's car without paying them?
Ooh. Well, there are a couple factors in this, I think, Bob. It depends on the financial stability of the person you're borrowing from and the borrower.
Yeah.
But I think, let's say both people were equal, I would say at 2 weeks, you should probably throw something down.
That's generous. I was going to say, like, you know, that's like house guests are like fish. After 3 days, they stink. I was going to apply the same thing here, which is 3 days, you know, it's probably tops.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, the infrastructure keeping up a car, like insurance and money.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, you know what? Sorry to be the bearer of bad news, guys, but honesty is the best policy. Mm. You ask the person, how long are you comfortable with me borrowing this car before you would feel a resentment if I weren't financially kicking something in?
I don't know. Honesty sounds like crazy talk. I think just slow simmering.
All right, you guys can sort that out. So here's our last question, and this one comes from Anonymous in Minnesota. Anonymous writes, I'm from the Midwest, and I feel like I'm constantly fielding passive-aggressive comments from family. My partner and I share news of what we've done or upcoming plans, a couple of his family members like to say, ooh, that's expensive, or, well, if you can afford it, in that certain tone. Mm. I don't think they realize the way it comes across. What would you say to them?
You a Midwesterner.
Yeah, well, I've been in this position before, and it's... You have to be honest about something, how something makes you feel, if you want anything to change. Like my therapist once told me something brilliant. He said, you plus this problem equals chaos. So which is going to change? What in the math is going to change? So
interesting.
You have to say to yourself, it's simpler than you think. You have to say, I know you might not mean it this way. Give them the benefit of the doubt. say, when you say things like that, it makes me feel like you're making a comment on how I spend my money or how I live, and it makes me feel like you're judging me.
Kristen, it strikes me you're an incredibly honest person who's telling us to say a lot of honest things, and your job is to pretend to be other people
yes.
for a living. How does that
Oof.
Work?
I don't know. I think maybe there is such thing as too much honesty. So when I'm too honest in my real life, I just jump into another character and lie for a while.
That's right. Also, my strategy for passive-aggressive people is to answer them as if the question was literal. So if they were like, well, if you can afford it, you'd say, yeah, we can. Or, oh, that's expensive. You're like, you're right. It kind of is expensive.
By the way, I don't hate that idea.
All right,
see? And I can't tell if that was passive-aggressive or not, but I'll take it
no,
for face value.
No, it wasn't.
All right, Kristen Bell. Thank you so much for telling our audience how to behave passive-aggressively.
Of course. Thanks, guys.
Kristen Bell, she stars in the movie Bad Moms, and she also just wrapped up a long run on the Showtime show House of Lies, in which she also behaves badly.
And folks, if good people in your life are acting out and you want advice on how to help, send your query to us and we'll nominate someone to confront it. Head to dinnerpartydownload.org and click contact. And now, time for Chattering Class, in which we're schooled by an expert in some party-worthy topic.
This week, the topic is the most famous kung fu fighter of all time, not me in high school, but Bruce Lee.
In your mind.
And our teacher is Charles Russo. His new book is called Striking Distance, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America. It's both a scholarly look at how the Asian fighting style became an international phenomenon and a hard-bitten biography of Bruce Lee's early days before movies made him a megastar.
When we spoke, I asked Charles, why write this book now?
I would argue that Bruce Lee right now is almost as popular as he's ever been. He's a character in video games. There's a new comic book out about him. There's multiple movies in production. Recently, they made a musical about his life. And probably most notably, Dana White, spokesperson for the UFC, cites him as the godfather of mixed martial arts.
You could say he actually kind of founded that industry.
He was definitely a key pioneer, and he certainly deserves to be acknowledged as much.
In a way, this book is his origin tale. He was born in San Francisco, spent most of his youth in China. His dad was an actor. By the time he came back to San Francisco as a teen, he had kind of a film career going as a young actor. But he arrives here in the States, and he is obsessed with martial arts and wants that to be his life. Why that instead of being an actor?
Yeah, it's really interesting. He's raised in pretty interesting circumstances in Hong Kong. On one hand, he has this very affluent upbringing via his dad's celebrity status as an actor. Sure. Yet he was small, and he was sort of navigating this very tough environment of Hong Kong in the 1950s, which had a very rough street scene of youth gangs and this sort of street fighting culture, which really required something, you know, special to navigate. And the martial arts worked for him in that way.
That leads nicely to my next point. One thing that makes Lee stand out in America was his skill in a style called Wing Chun. Why was that such a revolutionary thing for people when he brought that to the States?
Sure. So Bruce studies under a very now famous martial arts master, Ip Man. Hong Kong cinema cannot make enough movies about Ip Man right now.
Yeah.
And he was this great source of the style of Wing Chun, which is this very economical, streamlined form of fighting, which particularly in Hong Kong during the 1950s was a great style to learn because it was sort of results oriented. And
yeah. Basically, it will knock your opponent out quickly and effectively.
Sure. And what Bruce sees during his teens really shapes his martial arts worldview because he observes a lot of fights, and he sees what works versus what is just flamboyant nonsense. And for the rest of his career, really, he advocates martial arts that are practical as opposed to something that just looks really pretty in the studio.
Which is the most ironic thing to me in reading this book because, you know, he is the child of a Chinese opera performer. He was into dancing. In China, he was a cha-cha champion, which is amazing.
He was a national champion, yeah, in his teens.
I mean, he was a dance instructor when he came to San Francisco, yet he's choosing the least aesthetic of all martial arts forms, the least balletic.
I think that he very much believed in that streamlined nature of it.
Just kind of philosophically?
Yeah, was a very big advocate for that for the rest of his life. I mean, you see quotes now on social media, and he's talking about the importance of simplicity. And that very much comes from a Wing Chun sort of mindset.
For some people, watching him in America, that was the first time they'd ever been exposed to this. Describe their experience of watching him for the first time.
As Bruce Lee is giving Wing Chun demonstrations in this period, he's really raising a lot of eyebrows, partly because no one's ever seen it before, and also because he was just incredibly dynamic. His speed was stunning. Yeah. And, you know, he has this show business background, so he knows how to present it to people. What's interesting is that he also brought his ideology to it, which was often very critical of other things that were going on in the world of martial arts. So I think whereas we like to just see the glossy side of our icons, there was also some very rough edges to his personality. He had very little concern for sort of the bruised egos that were left in his wake.
That's true. There's a quote at the beginning of your book that says somebody described him as, quote, a dissident with bad manners.
Yeah, it is my favorite quote in the entire book, actually. And that comes from one of the old Chinatown kung fu masters. In Chinatown, even though that was the neighborhood that he was born in years earlier, they're not very fond of Bruce Lee at all.
Yeah.
They just have a very palpable dislike for him.
So what made him eventually so universally beloved?
You know, I interviewed a lot of old Chinatown guys, and there's still a lot of people that don't like Bruce Lee that knew him.
really?
I know that's probably surprising for a lot of people to hear. But as far as why people like him, I think he inspires a lot of people in terms of just the potential of the individual. You know, Bruce Lee was 5'8", and he's known as the most dynamic fighter ever. I mean, that's amazing. Finally, I think a big point is that I think he had tremendous impact on just social perceptions. I mean, he really changed the way people regarded Asian people, not just in the West, but around the world. I mean, he really got rid of a lot of derogatory stereotypes, just this really cool Asian action star. That really changed things for a lot of people. I mean, I talked to sources who, you know, maybe they were a middle school student at the time, and they talk about how Bruce Lee tangibly changed the way they were, like, treated in the playground and things like that.
Seriously? Overnight, they're respected?
Very much so. I mean, and that extended even beyond Chinese people to other Asian nationalities to even, you know, Bruce Lee's very popular in the African-American community as well.
Yeah,
and it was sort of that idea.
Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah, definitely. Sort of representing the minority hero.
Which actually reminds me of something you mentioned in the book, which is his given Chinese name. You want to tell us what his family says it means?
Sure. Bruce's name, Li Jun Fan, one of the translations of it is to bring Fan, which is sort of greatness, to his countrymen.
Charles Russo, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Ah, thank you.
Charles Russo. His book is called Striking Distance, Bruce Lee and the Dawn of Martial Arts in America. It expertly separates fact from myth and also features some righteous fight scenes. Check it out.
Sounds violent.
It is.
All right, and that's the Dinner Party download for this week, folks. But the good news is you can download us anytime in podcast form. Subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do leave a review. It really helps others find us.
Yes, and you can also catch us live via Facebook. Our next Facebook Live session doubles as a holiday party. It's December 6th. Grab some eggnog and mark your calendars.
Or mark your calendars with eggnog.
Don't do that.
No, don't do that. This show comes to you thanks to indispensable contributions from our senior producer, Jackson Musker, our associate digital producer, Christina Lopez, Christian Coons, our assistant producer, and Kathleen McGovern, our intern. Daniel Ramirez engineered. And now, before we leave you, here's One for the Road, a song to spin on your way to or returning from this week's dinner parties.
Warehouse is a young band from Atlanta, Georgia, fronted by musician Elaine Edenfeld. Their album Super Low came out in September. Here's the first single from it. It's called Reservoir.
Bon appetit.
I will show you fearful of dust and pieces. At least then, are you remember the truth? But I'll be here when loss confounds you to gesture away. Picking pieces of your lie. I don't ever.
I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and thanks for...
Okay, freeze and give me your money.
Oh, you picked the wrong week for this, my friend.
Wing Chun! Ah!
Book knowledge is power.
Ah, my hand hurts.